This is Stella Prony with Abby Wasserman on March 16th at 1:30 in the afternoon at Abby's house.
Well, I wanted to go back into the high school years just to say specifically what my senior year was like. And then I want to go back a little bit in time to some wonderful experiences that I had as a teenager in the field of drama. I think I said that I was in the senior play. That was a big deal. I'd been, as a sophomore, I was in the all-school play, and then when I was in my senior year, I was in a play called The Tavern. That was with Mike Liebert. I believe I've talked about that. But the other activities, I was the student body secretary. I believe I said I ran twice for song leader and lost, but I was in the I was in a kind of a pom-pom group that did marching during the football games during halftime, and we were called, I think, the Tamettes. I was on the election and survey committee, on the student congress. I think I may have been awarded honor tea one semester and never again. Interestingly, although I became a writer, I didn't do anything in journalism. I wasn't on the paper, didn't work on the paper. That came later, that interest. I was on the rally committee and the junior statesman, and also in the French club. So I was very active at school and loved. I was also on the music club, which surprises me because I didn't play an instrument during those years except private piano lessons. But I was a real joiner, I would say, when I was in high school. So I also wanted to bring up that on the subject of going on the experiment in international living, when I was a senior, I acted in a play on the ship. The ship was called the Arosa Colm. It was a German ship. And the Arosa Colm, although I was very interested in the young Germans who were part of the crew, because I just was so interested in boys always, I also took the time to be in a play. There was a young director who was going to Europe also. We were a big group for the experiment on that boat. And let me just turn that off. So when on the ship called the Arosa Colm, we did a reading of the play, The Glass Menagerie, and I played Amanda, the mother. Seems that I was always a character actor, never an ingenue. And that was a great experience to learn that play just in a matter of days and present a reading. You know, we had our scripts, but we were able to be very free of them. Another dramatic experience, or experience with drama I had mentioned that I wrote a script based on The Ugly Duckling for the children in the junior theater of Marin.
I apologize. I think we're going to stop using this because this is just doing something weird.
Well, if you want to start from the beginning.
Well, no, I have you on the beginning from on the computer. So, shoot. No, just continue.
Okay. So my play with the Junior Theater of Marin, I was directing children in a play and decided to write the play myself. And I believe that I've already talked about that. But I did find the script. And the script is really, it's interesting because I had forgotten what the end of The Ugly Duckling was, and so my variation of it is kind of charming, but and really quite original. It turns out that in my story, the swans are the snotty ones, and the duckling is really a duckling, not a swan, but he has been born among the swans, and the swans tell him how ugly he is. And as I recall in the story by Hans Christian Andersen, it's just the opposite. It's a swan egg that has gotten in amongst the duckling eggs, and he's different than the rest of them, and then he turns out to be a beautiful swan. So I had reversed it in my head, but it was really a lot of fun, and the children loved it. And I believe I've already talked about the wonderful leaders of our Muir League group at the community church. There was one memorable play that I did there with Stephen Fowler, the son of Carol and Donald Fowler. And we did a play which was really kind of silly and wonderful called Arby the Bug Boy. So that was another of the experiences that I had in theater when I was young. That summer that we were in England was it followed being in a workshop at San Francisco State, a drama workshop that was for teenagers from all around the Bay Area, and I took part in that. It's interesting because last night at the O'Hanlon Center for the Arts, we had an Irish salon, and this was March 15th, 2015, last night. And there were step dancers from a step dancing group here in Marin County, young people. There were musicians. There were people reciting poetry, Irish poetry. And I recited a poem that I learned at that workshop at San Francisco State when I was 17 years old. A beautiful poem called An Old Woman of the Roads. And I remember so much of that poem from when I was 17. It just shows again and again how much smarter kids are than adults. We remember things for years. So that was a nice link from last night. I went into college at after the summer in England when we did a lot of walking around, and we also went to London and saw plays. It was just a fabulous experience. Then I started at College of Pacific, which I've talked about some. And all during this time, I kept up my friendships with my friends from Tamalpais High School, including Phil Richardson. I joined the sorority Tri-Delt, or rather, I joined a local that became a national and became Tri-Delt. And I was in a play at College of Pacific, No Exit. I played the lesbian Inez in No Exit. And my friends from now UC Berkeley, Phil Richardson and a few others, were going to come to see the play. So I got this very funny telegram the night of the play. Congratulations on play. Are drunk. Wrecked car. Can't travel. Unhurt. Be cool. Have faith. No, my friends. College of the Pacific was a good experience, and but I decided I wanted to take time off. I believe I've also talked about stopping school for a year to join the San Francisco Players Guild, which was directed by Martha Bigelow Elliott, whose daughter Joan Washington had directed the first play I was in as a child, Prince Fairyfoot. I think I've talked about that. So I played one of the stepsisters in Cinderella. It was a 9-month commitment. And one of the other actors in the play, the other stepsister, was Sally Sherman Taylor, who grew up in Mill Valley. And she should do an oral history. She's amazing. So Sally, and then Alice Perry from Sausalito was the stepmother. John Brebner was in it. He became very well known. He and his then wife, Ann Brebner, started outdoor Shakespeare here in Marin County, and John played a part in that, and then a couple of San Francisco actors. And I drove the company car. I was 18. I think nobody else wanted to drive the car. That's why they gave the job to me. I think they took their lives in their hands. But anyway, so that was a period of 9 months where I had just a great, great time acting. We would go out to institutions and schools. After that, I decided to go back to San Francisco State and get an elementary school teaching credential. My parents had raised a pragmatic child in certain ways. I think I would have been frightened to try to go into theater. I wanted some security, so I decided to be a teacher. But I also did love children, and I enjoyed education. So I was at State for 2 years, graduated from there, and I believe I've talked about this. I had a decision to go into the Peace Corps or to go to Alaska to teach, and I chose the Peace Corps and went to Columbia. I think I've mentioned that my father did a great deal of traveling. He took study tours from San Francisco State overseas. And I think that he had instilled the bug for travel in me. So I was really, really happy to go into the Peace Corps, and I was assigned to Columbia. We first had 2 months at least of training in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'd never taken Spanish, but I learned Spanish and took to it very, very quickly. And we left in January of 1964. I believe I've talked a little bit about the Peace Corps experience and how that was, and how I decided after 6 months that I wanted to switch into community development. And that was when I met my future husband. So fast forward, I believe that I've also said something about marrying in Bogota, Colombia, and how our next assignment was to Turkey, and how I had my first child there. So actually, I've talked about a lot. I've already said a lot. After Turkey, we went to Honduras, which was a very different place back then. Pretty peaceful place. Not a great deal of crime, certainly not the murder capital of the world the way it is now. We lived in the house that the former president of the country owned, up in a hillside area above Tegucigalpa. His name was Ramon Villeda Morales, and it's a beautiful rural area to live in. And Honduras was the place that I became very much interested in spirituality and met with a couple of priests and a nun and some other people interested in theology. And that kind of developed in parallel to what was happening in the United States in the early 70s, because we were there for 3 years. The happenings, and I remember we talked about theology for a year and a half or so, and then we segued into happenings of our own where we would do artwork together or other fun things, unbuttoned, very enjoyable, very loving group of friends. The wonderful thing, one of the many wonderful things about living overseas is the chance to get to know people from different countries, because of course there are always foreigners of many different kinds who are doing development work or are in the consulate or in the embassy or in the AID program overseas. And so my friends were from all over the place, mostly in Honduras. They were Americans, but some of them had chosen to live in Central America. We still have one of those friends Father Gratian, who lives in El Salvador, and we visited him, you know, my husband and I, a couple of times. After Honduras, when our second child was born, Joshua William Raymond was born in on March 10th, 1969. And so I had two children when we went to our next assignment, which was Nigeria. I may have spoken about that too a little bit. What I remember most about Nigeria was how I realized what it must feel like to be in the minority, in the ethnic or racial minority. In Nigeria, especially in Lagos, it was, and this is, I think, good practice for anybody who kind of takes for granted while in the majority of their own country that they will always have a free pass, because in Nigeria, I felt like an outsider. And I hadn't had that feeling in the other countries I was in, a little bit in Turkey. If there was ever any conflict in Turkey, like I was in an automobile accident once, it was just a little fender bender, but I had just been to the dressmakers and I had on a dress that was above the knees because I was going to a reception with my husband that night. And so I was coming back already dressed, and this fender bender happened, and we were a woman and I, a Turk, and I were talking to each other outside the cars. And I remember being very self-conscious about my short dress because it was nodding, you know, that was not the style. The reception we were going to would have been filled with foreigners who also would have been in short dresses. And there were times like that when I felt like an outsider. But Nigeria was where I felt mostly like an outsider, much more in that sense of being barely tolerated instead of, you know, being able to move freely and with people giving me a reception of welcome. So that was very good for me. And I also made some good Nigerian friends, a couple of them, and directed a play while I was there, The Brave Little Tailor, which was, again, a marvelous experience because I cast as the tailor a Nigerian named Steady Arthur Wori. A wonderful man, rather on the short side. And the two giants in the play by Orand Harris, I cast two very tall white guys who were both working with an overseas development agency. One was with AID, I believe. And they towered over Steady. And I remember how the mostly Nigerian audience just loved that. They love that the brave little tailor vanquished the two big, huge white giants. That was great. We had an American who was working for AID compose original music for that. There was an American who did the costumes, incredible costumes, and an Argentinian woman who was there with her husband who worked for Shell Oil, I believe. She helped do the music, the live music during the play. It was really quite a great experience. And I also taught a workshop for teenagers, a drama workshop. We came back to the United States in 1972 and settled in Stamford, Connecticut with our children. and the notable thing about that is that I went to New York University to get a degree in educational theater. Before the degree was finished, my husband got a chance to take a job in Washington, D.C., and so we moved to D.C., and I finished off my credential, my secondary credential and master's degree at Catholic University. The time in D.C. was characterized by starting to be a writer. I began to write for a newspaper on theater, and then went into writing about visual art. Both of them just winging it. Well, theater, I had the background. Visual art, no, just the appreciation. But it was possible in those days to write and get your stuff published. So I started writing in 1976. And I remember the first article I did was for a small newspaper on a show of Argentinian art. And this is perhaps, maybe in these years, I began to see how what we do in our lives, all the paths that we take, begin to circle around. Because I knew Latin America, and the first article I did was on Latin American art. I had started writing about art just for myself back when I was a teenager. If I went to an exhibit, I would take notes and think about what my reaction was to the artwork. So this was really a pleasure. I also acted in a play by Megan Terry called Approaching Simone that was given by the Washington Area Feminist Theater. And this was a lead role, and it was a long run, and I think it was an 8-week run, and I really, really loved that experience too. Very challenging. I had to sing in it. I had to do some choreography. I had to fall. I learned how to fall. And I learned how to say lines that were really taken from Simone Weil's, the philosopher's, work, directly from her writing, and they were very academic lines, and try to give some life to them. So that was a challenge too. And then my husband and I began divorce proceedings. And we were divorced in 1979. So it took a while. And by that time, I was writing for larger newspapers as a freelancer and writing on mostly visual art, but also doing some feature writing, usually on people. I was always interested in people's, not so much lifestyles as the kinds of households people have and the way they get along in their relationships. Speaking of which, right after Approaching Simone, the play by Megan Terry, I went back to the Washington Area Feminist Theater to try out for another play. I was going to keep going, even though these were not paid assignments. And the play was all about the dissolution of a marriage. And I read the lines, waiting for my turn to audition. And I decided I couldn't do it because it was too close to home. That was my last play for a number of years, Approaching Simone. So in 1979, my brother John died in an automobile accident while I was living in Maryland. And John had been the Chronicle entertainment critic for a long time. Since 1964, he'd been writing for the Chronicle, and then he had taken over Ralph J. Gleason's column after Gleason died. And that was when he did his most marvelous writing, which was about entertainment in the broadest sense. And he died in a car accident that he caused. He was drunk, and he was driving up Highway 280, right around Hickey Boulevard. It was a very, very heavy rainstorm that night, and dark, and he got turned around. I think he may have gone off. I read the police report. seems he may have gone off at Hickey Boulevard, and then apparently there was a ramp there that if you weren't, if you didn't have your wits about you, you might make a mistake and go back onto the highway going the wrong direction. I've never tried to do it. I've never had the heart. But he was going south in the northbound lanes and hit a car and killed two other people and himself. And I was in such shock over that. I was in Washington when my mother called me in the middle of the night. And at first I didn't book a ticket home. It was like, I don't know what I was thinking, but a friend of mine from San Francisco with whom I spoke, who had had loss in her family, told me that I must go home. And so I booked a flight and left my sons with their father. Came home, and there were a couple of memorial gatherings for my brother. He was very popular, and he had a lot of friends who were celebrities. So we went to a couple of these gatherings, and they were very warming, you know, because of all the love people had for him. But it was a whole different world for me. I had lived completely apart from my brother for so many years that I didn't really know much about the circles he ran with. And so a lot of high-powered people and people in the entertainment world.
Did he leave family?
He wasn't married, and he had no children. And years later, I was moved to collect his articles from the Chronicle and to write a narrative about his life. And that book, I'll tell about that maybe later, but that book was published in 1991. So he died in 79, and it took me until, you know, it took me quite a few years to get around to the point where I saw my way clear to do a book on my brother. So my mother and father were very, very, very wounded by this. And my father was in charge of my brother's estate. And I do think that that may have had something to do with his death, which was 2 years, almost 3 years later, because it took a lot out of him. I think that the grief that they felt for his loss, well, I know it was compounded by a sense of the tragedy of the other two people. And my father had known my brother had a drinking problem, and he'd tried to stop him from driving when he'd been drinking before. But my brother was very headstrong, and he had been a heavy drinker for a long time, but managed to keep it together. But he had had a number of accidents in the past, starting from when he was, I think, 16. And just off and on, you know, there would be these periods where he would rack up his car. So, you know, I didn't understand hardly anything about alcoholism. It was, and I'd never really thought about it in relation to my brother. But what I had thought was that because of the way he lived, which was at such a high revolution, that I thought he would die young. But I had no specific idea of how he might die. He was brilliant and very, very talented and very funny. And I think he must have been very sad also. Felt a lot of pain. He was extremely sensitive. He was very loving to a lot of people. Some other people thought he was a jerk. You know, And he was so professional in his writing. He was very, very disciplined. And he also loved to entertain people, and he entertained lavishly, and although not necessarily lavishly with food, but he would always provide a lot to drink.
Where do you live, Abby?
He lived on Bush Street when he, in a building that's been torn down since. He had lived also on California Street before that. He'd had several San Francisco addresses. They still publish articles by my brother in the Chronicle under their, I don't know what they call it, vintage or nostalgia or something like that, you know, the way things used to be, articles in the Sunday section in the Pinky. There are articles by Terence O'Flaherty, by Art Hoppe, by John, and by other stellar writers from the Chronicle. And John was lucky because he was writing for the Chronicle in just about their best years for writers. You know, they had a bunch of brilliant writers. My brother was very colorful. There were stories and stories. So I ended up, before that book was published, I ended up interviewing 110 people who were friends of his or acquaintances or work colleagues. And those transcripts are so interesting. I just could use a handful of stories for the narrative sections of the book. But I think the portrait of my brother is a fair portrait and a loving portrait. And his articles speak for themselves. The book is called Praise, Vilification, and Sexual Innuendo, or How to Be a Critic. And it was published by Chronicle Books. And the phrase, praise, vilification, and sexual innuendo is from my brother. He wrote a series of articles on how to be a critic that were very tongue-in-cheek. And he said you had to be an expert in sexual innuendo because, of course, the censorship laws at that time were far more strict than they are now. You had to be good at sexual innuendo, and you had to be good at praise, and you had to be very good at vilification. And John was. He was especially good at vilification. So now the family was my father, my mother, and my younger brother, Richie. Richie had been a road manager for some of the signature bands of the 60s, including Sea Train and the Butterfield Blues Band. And he would be an interesting interview also about those years and that kind of music. He lives up on the North Coast in Point Arena. So the next thing that happened was in 1981, my now ex-husband died by his own hand in Maryland, and so that was a very difficult period. My children were then 12 and 14. And that I was the only one able to handle his estate. He died intestate. So it was a struggle for a couple of years. That was finally settled. And my father died in 1982, and after a heart attack, after two heart attacks. So those were years of sadness and difficulty. By this time, I think I was working part-time for the Smithsonian Institution as a writer on their Festival of American Folk Life, which is a wonderful yearly event. I especially liked it because I could write about people who had very different experiences from a Hmong family from Cambodia who had come to the United States, and the women were still sewing in the traditional Hmong way, and their needlework was shown at the Festival of American Folklife, to people from the old medicine shows, like Greasy Medlin and Snuffy Smith, not Snuffy Smith, Snuffy Jenkins. Snuffy Smith is a cartoon, I think. Snuffy Jenkins and Doc Watson and other people who used to play for the old medicine shows. And then there was the National Theater of the Deaf that demonstrated their folklore and their theater, which is a very elaborate, very theatrical sign language. Anyway, there would be these marvelous combinations of people who were bringing their talents and their heritage to the festival. Native American groups always. So that became a community for me because I would come back every year and work with the same people. That is to say, the same staff people from the Smithsonian. I also was writing freelance for the Washington Star during those years and doing features and sometimes reviews. And I got a job with an organization for psychiatric halfway houses called the Richmond Fellowship also during those years in Washington. I was there for 10 years. And so all of this experience, I'm kind of trying to encapsulate. I was also for a couple of years, I was the researcher for Tom Wicker, the journalist, for his book on Richard Nixon called One of Us, Richard M. Nixon and the American Dream. And I used to work down at the Library of Congress almost every day researching Nixon material for Tom. So that would have been about 1980, 1981, maybe even a little bit of 1982 that I worked for Wicker. He was a wonderful boss and the best conversationalist I think I've ever been with. He was just riveting in his conversation and so open and encouraging and just a wonderful man. In 1984, I decided it was time to come back to Mill Valley. And my son Graham had graduated from high school and was going to the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. So my younger son Josh, who had just completed his freshman year in high school, we packed up, we all got in the car, Graham, Josh, and me. We took off for Ohio, we delivered Graham to his college, got him settled, and then we came across the country. This was the third cross-country trip I took with my kids. I had driven with them from Washington, D.C. to California twice already. And then I'd also taken them on a car camping trip up in Canada at one point. Those trips were absolutely wonderful. And I don't think I would have tried a cross-country camping trip alone, but somehow with my two boys, it was okay to do it. And they remember it. They remember those trips very well. So Josh and I arrived in California in the summer of 1984. No, I'm sorry, in the late summer of 1984. Very late summer, just before school started. And Josh was here on time to begin at Tamalpais High School. The first place that we found to live was with my mother here at the 101 Reed Street house. But we also lived for a couple of years next door at 105 Reed Street, which was the original house then. Now you look at it, you see nothing of the way it was. It was completely rebuilt years later. But at that point, it was owned by Anna Maria Knapp, and she rented it to us. And we liked living there. We also lived in this period, I think right after 101 Reed Street, before 105, we lived at 170 Miller Avenue, apartment 2, I think it was. That was a rental place, a two-level rental place, right on Miller Avenue and And that was where we lived. We must have been there a couple of years, maybe 1 year, and then we moved to the house at 105. Anyway, Josh was at we were at 105 when Josh graduated from TAM in 1987. He was a very assiduous student. He was highly motivated to do well and get into a really good college. I think, and I don't know where that came from. I think because I was pretty much the same with both my boys, that I encouraged them, but I didn't stand over them. And Graham had been less enthusiastic about school, more into sports. Josh also was an athlete, and he was on the cross country and track teams. He had not wanted to come to California. He'd wanted to stay in Maryland and wanted to stay at his school. But I remember at the first athletic banquet for the parents and the kids on the cross country team or the track team, my son got most valuable player on the junior, among the junior track team. And I just felt then that it was the right place for him to be. He took band from Mr. Greenwood. He took he was good in math, and he worked hard. And he was given a National Merit Scholarship to Oberlin, but he decided he was also on the wait list for Williams, and he decided to go to Williams. So now I was alone, empty nest. My older son Graham graduated from Worcester and came out to California, but not to live with me. He came out to California. His first real job was in Lake County, on the Lake County Record. I'm not sure of the title of the newspaper there. So he lived up in there. He did a lot of reporting on the methamphetamine labs that were springing up all around Lake County. And he did a very good job of news reporting. And so he was launched on his career. He later went to he went back to school in New York at Columbia and got his master's degree in journalism, and then, from there worked on Newsday in New York, Newsday Long Island, and then settled at the Village Voice for a number of years, where he did some really fine investigative work. And a few years ago, he won the highest investigative reporting award that is given by the New York City Press Club, the New York Press Club. And so he did awfully well at that. Since then, like all the other senior reporters on the Village Voice, he was laid off. And so I think right now he's thinking of going to law school.
Really?
Yeah, making the change, because the whole newspaper business is so appalling right now, so difficult for old style reporters. Josh, in the meantime, went into the Peace Corps in after Williams. He was 4 years at Williams College, and he went into the Peace Corps in Malawi and was there for 2 years, and then came back and started his graduate school experience that extended on until he got his PhD in philosophy. And he teaches now at the University of South Florida, and lives in Tampa. And so what was I doing at this time that my boys were out doing things and, making their own lives? Did I mention that I joined the Art Commission? Did I talk about that?
I don't think you've talked about anything that you did after you got back to Mill Valley.
Okay. Well, Let me go back to the first, my first experience of my first 2 weeks back in Mill Valley. And I have to say first that I had had many dreams about Mill Valley over the years, and most often they seem to take place in that area between Montford Avenue, along Miller Avenue from Montford to the high school, which of course would have been the part of town that I walked the most. I remember how kind of empty it was, you know, and quiet. I think I may have talked about the sounds that I used to hear here. I'm not sure that I mentioned that one of the sounds that I heard was the train. Did I mention the freight train?
I'm not sure if I remember that or not.
Did I mention the foghorn, the two-note foghorn that I could hear from my window, and the frogs at the pond, and the fighting that I would sometimes hear from across the street?
I don't remember that.
I would hear voices, you know, people saying, shouting at each other.
Certain neighbors.
Yeah, okay. There's something so evocative about sounds. You know, now from sometimes I sleep in my old room, and when I do, I can hear people coming back from the 2 a.m. club. There was some couple that lived up the street here, and they would come by and they would be yelling at each other and saying the most appalling things, you know, at 2 in the morning, and the sounds would just waft in. And, you know, when it's quiet here, it's very, very quiet. But most of the sounds that I heard at night were sounds that I treasure, you know, the natural sounds of a place like this. One night I woke up when I was a kid, and the sound I heard was voices down in the street, and I looked out my window, and my father was across the street talking to some people in a car. And at that point, there was no house across the street right there where there is now. That's 106 Reed Street across the street. There was no home built there. And a car was parked, and my father was saying to the driver of the car that he had better let the young woman come out of the car, or he was going to call the police. And so a very shaken young woman came out of the car on the other side and came up the walkway with my father into the house. And my mother made cocoa for her while my father got in touch with her family. And what had happened was the guy that she was out with had parked here and was trying to force her to do some, I don't know what, some sort of sexual thing, I imagine. And my father had heard that from up here and had gone down. And I remember what a hero my father seemed to be. You know, to my eyes, he was such a hero. My brothers and I, these doors were closed to the kitchen, and that's where they were. The telephone was in the other room there. So my brothers and I, we all slept on this side of the house, and we kind of crept out and kind of listened at the door. And I think my mother discovered us there and said she'd give us some cocoa too. But that sense, I really had a sense growing up here in Homestead of that, of a neighborhood, you know, of people taking care of one another. When I came back here to live, there were still some of the people that I remembered from way back who lived here. The Fosses were still across the street. My friend Carol Foss, who now lives on Montford, I told you about that at one point. The Fosses were still here. The Frank and Winnie, Yim from up here on Ethel Lane were here, and they had come, I guess, when I was an early teenager or a teenager. Jack and Claudia Aronson lived right across the street at 1 and 3 Ethel. And Claudia and I had been at TAM together, and Jack Aronson, Claudia had married Jack Aronson. And next door, that house was still the same, so it kind of felt comforting. You know, it felt like it was still the place where I grew up. The other day, I went up to see our friends, Eldon and Helen Beck, who live on Laverne, or live right off Laverne, on a very high driveway. And the house that's being built right in front of them, that you see from Laverne, is totally out of character for the neighborhood. Completely out of character. It's a huge rectangular monstrosity. And it has no relationship to the houses across the street. You know, none at all. And, you know, I miss that. I miss it. I think a lot of us do. Okay, so what was I doing? I tried to get into the Art Commission. The whole Art Commission had resigned as a result. This was 1984. As a result of them, they held a competition for a fountain that was going to be in the plaza. And with the help of the Marin Arts Council, they chose a design. And the design was like a large ice cube, transparent, with water that would come out and cascade over it. And it was a very pretty modern design. As soon as some of the citizens of Mill Valley, probably the older ones, you know, like me, but I wasn't part of this, as soon as they realized what was being proposed, there began a movement of great, great criticism of the Art Commission. And for better or worse, the Art Commission was forced to, I think by the City Council, although I'm not up on my facts on this. I've kind of forgotten it over the years. The Art Commission was forced to renege on their prize to the winning designer, and all of the Art Commission resigned in protest. So there, the city council was without an Art Commission, and they immediately began to ask for volunteers to serve on the Art Commission. Now, it wasn't easy then, and it probably isn't easy now to become a member of one of the commissions. They put you through an interview process and so on. This was 1984, and I had not yet gotten a job, but I had worked for the Smithsonian for a number of years, seven, I think, off and on. And I'd been writing about art, and I thought I was very qualified for this. But I was not picked. And then the next year came along, and they were again asking for applicants. And so I applied, and they turned me down again.
Did you feel like the people they chose really had better resumes than you, objectively?
You know, I don't know that I read their resumes, but I felt that they were probably choosing the people who struck them as having the best qualifications. Yeah. I didn't think that there was something fishy about it. I simply thought that I didn't present myself very well, or that there were other people they felt were more qualified.
Or the council people owed favors to.
Oh, well, that could be
Yeah.
too. I didn't even think about that, I don't think. Anyway, I'm sure they got good people. I know they must have gotten good people, but they were still having trouble, you know, keeping I think you were supposed to have about seven people on the commission. So they turned me down the second time, and then one of the people they selected decided not to do it. Oh, here's the other thing, is I was living, part of that time I was living in Homestead Valley, and they only had one slot for a person in what they call the sphere of influence. And then the second time, I believe, I had moved to 170 Miller, so I was in the Mill Valley city limits. Anyway, they asked me if I still would like to apply, and this time they took me. So on my third the third go around, I think what they'd done is they'd turned me down the second time, and then maybe put me on a list of people that if they needed another commissioner, they'd call me. And I served on the commission then from 85 or 86, can't remember exactly when it started, until 1990. And I became president my last year. And that was when it was before I was president that I introduced the idea of the Creative Achievement Awards, and then followed that up. That was turned down by my commission, by the commission. I was not yet president or chairman. Chairman. It's not president, it's chairman. And the next person that I recommended for a Creative Achievement Award was Anne O'Hanlon, and the commission liked that, and they decided to go with this idea of having one award a year. And that it was about the time that I left that Truby Shock came on the commission, and then she picked up that project and she carried it through. I moved at that point. Let's see. I started working for the Oakland Museum in 1986. They hired me to be on their public information staff and to be assistant editor of their magazine. So 1986, I began working there, and I was commuting from Mill Valley. And in 1988, I did my next theater experience. I played the part of Mistress Moore in A Man for All Seasons in Berkeley. And it was directed by my old friend from Tamalpais High School, Michael Schwarzkopf, Mikel Schwarzkopf. And Mikey, she is a woman. Mikey was the co-founder of California Shakes with Michael Leibert. And so those two had also met in high school, and they'd worked together then in theater. And Mikey was directing A Man for All Seasons, and my husband to be, Potter Wickware, Wickware, was auditioning for a part that night. And I hadn't intended to try out. I was just helping Mikey by handing out scripts and so on. And this was over at the Live Oak Theater in Berkeley. But I decided I would like to be in the play, and so I joined the cast, and we were in rehearsals for a few months, and then we had quite a long run. And so it took us from, I think, April, we began the first reading, to August. And by the end of that, I was pretty much involved in a relationship with Potter. And from then on, it was just me and Potter. And we were together for about 4 years, and then we got married. But during that time, I was working for the Oakland Museum, and I had because no, let me go back a little bit. Before I got the job with the Oakland Museum, I was freelancing as a writer for the Chronicle. It was before Kenneth Baker became the art critic, and Kate Regan, who had, interestingly enough, been my brother John's assistant for a long time. Kate Regan was writing on art while there was a vacuum before they got a permanent art critic. They should have hired Kate, but they didn't. And I was doing art writing, and some other people were too. And in fact, that was how I came to the Oakland Museum for the first time. Was writing a piece, a long piece for the Sunday Chronicle in the review section on the museum's reinstallation of its history gallery. So it was at that point, 1985, when I met the guy who would become my boss, Phil Mumma, and interviewed the history curator, Thomas Fry, and wrote a piece that they liked so much that they put a blurb from it on their book, that they did a book for the reinstallation. I also wrote on things as diverse as Aymara weavings from Peru, ancient Peru, and Barnett Newman, the artist, and Bill Viola, the video artist. And I loved that period of writing for the Chronicle. I especially loved doing reviews of museum shows. That was such a joy. So when I was hired by the Oakland Museum, it couldn't have been a better assignment for me because I had to write a lot. I was writing about art. I was writing about California history, and even sometimes about natural sciences because the Oakland Museum had all three there. And I was learning how to edit. And I was immersed in studies of California. So it couldn't have been better. So I was commuting from Mill Valley for those first years from 1986 to 1990, at which point Potter and I decided that I should move over to Oakland, where he lived. And so I lived there with him for almost 7 years. During that time, my mother, Caroline, was here in this house. My father had gone to, after their divorce in 1967 or so, my father had retired from San Francisco State and gone to teach at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. He was living in near Ladner, BC. And yes, and that was in the years when I was still living overseas. So he was up there. My mother was here in Mill Valley. And then after my mother visited us in Nigeria, the following summer, she went to live in Sweden with her Swedish farmer that I've talked to you about, Uno Jansson. So just trying to put this together in my head, once I started working for the Oakland Museum and living with Potter, I still went to Sweden a couple of times to see my mother. And in 1990, I went to Sweden to bring her back. She was not in good health and she wanted me to come and help her come back to California because the flights were always a strain on her. So I came back with her. And continued to work at the Oakland Museum, became the editor-in-chief of the magazine when my mentor and boss took another job within the museum, and loved doing that. All that experience learning how to edit was probably, it was just the best way to do it. You know, you learn by doing, and editing is very complex, and you learn how to, you know, very gradually how to work with writers and how to bring out the best in the writers and how to put your own ego kind of behind you. And it takes a long time. Sometimes you feel very insistent that a writer has to do something the way you want the writer to do it, and it really doesn't work that way. So you have to kind of go from where the writer is and empathize with that and ask questions that are respectful. And then little by little, you know, you learn how to do that. Years later, when I was given the opportunity to apply for a job with the magazine Boom, which is a journal of California, as an editor, I got the job, and it was really on the strength of all my experience in the past. I worked for the Oakland Museum from 1986 to 2000 on their full-time staff. And at that point, I was a city employee. When I retired, I was given a good retirement and health benefits. But I continued to work for the museum for a few more years as their magazine editor. And then that ended, that terminated. So the experience with Boom also, I got it through an old friend at the museum. She recommended me for, she told me about the job. And I continued to learn because Boom was fairly recent. It was just about a year ago that I stopped working for them after 2 years as their developmental editor. During those time, that time, I really learned how to work with writers, way more than I ever had before. And so I feel in a way that this is all cumulative. You know, you learn how to be a better person. You learn how to be a more respectful editor. You learn how to impart your knowledge to other people without being arrogant. You learn how to learn from other people and have them teach you. So I do love the editing part of my work. In 1985, I did my first book. So that was before I came to the Oakland Museum. It was as a result of a series of articles that I did for the American Indian Contemporary Arts Gallery in San Francisco. They commissioned me to do a series of basically brochures about their artists. And so I did 11 of those, and they were made into a book in 1985. A book that's out of print now, but I was able to obtain a copy of it recently over the internet. And my second book was my book on my brother, and that was 1991. Talked about that already. And then my third book was done for the Oakland Museum, and it was a history of Oakland by a lot of different writers. I commissioned 13 writers to write on various aspects of Oakland history. Oakland history is fascinating. So many different groups have come to Oakland and made lives there, and the culture has been amazing, and the architecture and the sports and the music, and it's just a fascinating place. So I did that for the Oakland Museum, and then my fourth book was a children's book called Tosca's Paris Adventure, which I illustrated and wrote. And then my fifth book, and these books have come out like every, you know, sometimes once every 6 years. So this is a long period. The last book was on Mary Lindheim, whom I've mentioned before, because she was my mother's good friend who lost her husband right before the war in Europe ended. In 2010, the book on Mary came out, so 5 years ago.
Why was she important enough for a book?
Well, she was one of the very few women ceramic artists working at a certain period in the Bay Area. She was a studio potter, but she was also a very close colleague of Edith Heath. Edith Heath was a production potter and Mary was a studio potter. And the difference between those two is that the production potter is duplicating again and again and again, whereas the studio potter is making one of a kind. Mary had been a sculptor before she was a ceramic artist. And she was like Edith, and like Marguerite Wildenhaine, who was another potter in the Greater Bay Area and who was very influential. Mary had taught ceramics. She was president of the organization, the Association of San Francisco Potters, which was the big organization in the Bay Area for ceramic artists. That was in the early 50s. She became a potter in 1946, and then she was just very, very active. So it was not only her own beautiful work which was shown in many, many shows, both in the States and internationally, but also that she was very active and very much a cheerleader for others. And also she was very involved not only in ceramics, but in the craft movement, in the studio craft movement, which means glass artists, metal artists, wood artists, people working in all these different media. And other than that, she had an astoundingly interesting life. After Donald died, she was a very independent woman who lived life on her own terms, and quite an inspiring figure with very high principles. So, and I was paid for it, right? I mean, I was commissioned to do this book. So
Who commissioned you?
her estate.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. So that was the last one. Now, long about, gosh, I don't even know the year, but I started about 13, 12 or 13 years ago, I started to teach creative writing and not really teach it so much as I found out that I could guide other writers, give them comments that were helpful. This would be an outgrowth of editing, you know, I'm sure. And I could listen, you know, I could give people feedback that was positive feedback and help them think things through, because as writers we have to think things, we have to be open to discovering through the act of writing and not impose on our writing. You know, it's very different from what we learn in high school about outlining. You know, the creative act of writing can be, yes, you can have the discipline of the outline, you know where you want your story to go, but also you have to be open to discovering what is there, you know, what rocks are in your path and what creeks you have to cross. So I began to work with very small groups, and I was helped in that endeavor immeasurably by my dear friend Jean McMahon. And Jean, until her death about a week ago, she lived on Lovell with her husband Douglas Muir, who's a photographer. And Jean was a wonderful writer and just the best teacher. And I had experienced her teaching and in fact learned a great deal about teaching, guiding people from Jean. And it was Jean who suggested that I start, you know, my own little group. Gosh, she was a good teacher. She brought out of us the best that we could give. She didn't have any discussion. I would read something, other people wouldn't necessarily say, "Oh, that's so good," or, "Oh, you know, really, this part stinks," or, you know, no, nothing like that. It was to be able to receive whatever was going on in ourselves and then to share it, but not to have to go through the feedback, which I think it was a wonderful, it's a wonderful method. I don't do it exactly, but it's very positive. Everybody would go out of her group feeling wonderful, you know, feeling that they had created something that was really worthwhile. And that's what I try to do with my groups now. So I was doing it. I had a writing group in Sausalito at one of the members' houses for a while, about a year, and then started to give groups at the O'Hanlon Center for the Arts, which was called at that point Sight and Insight, Anne O'Hanlon's home, Anne and Dick O'Hanlon's home, and their organization that they had created in 1969. So that would have been in the early 2000s. And I've now had groups there since 2002, perhaps. And every year, my students and I give a public reading at the O'Hanlon Center. At this point, I had seen Anne O'Hanlon around town. Her husband had already died, had died very recently, I think, when I came back. Maybe even
did
the
you know
year.
Her through your family? Before?
I did. Yeah, I did know
she's
her
a friend
through
of your
family.
Parents.
Yes, right. Well, she and Dick were very, very close with Sam and Sylvia Newsom, and my parents were friends of the Newsoms and of the O'Hanlons, and of course Ray Strong lived right above the O'Hanlons, and he was very close to my family, and Ray and Lou, my father, were very close to Gordon Foster, and you know, to the Omans, to Agnes and Don Oman, and to Oma and Bill Pemberton, and, you know, we knew Mama Gravander, and there was just this whole wonderful group of musicians and artists, and Solly Lieberman and his family were friends of my parents. The circles were very, you know, they were kind of like the circles when you throw a rock in the water, and I know that just recently, working on this latest issue of the Review and being at the O'Hanlon Center, I have met the sons of Dan and Dorith Collins, and the Collins seniors were friends of my parents, especially my mother. I just met last night Alex Call, who is a marvelous musician, and Lindy was a very dear friend of my mother's.
Who's Lindy?
Belinda Call.
Oh, his wife?
Hughes. No, this is the parents,
oh, the parents
of Alex.
Okay, got it.
Belinda and Hughes Call, and they're the ones who gave their home to the Homestead Valley Community Association.
Oh, that's
the
Call home?
The old Call home.
Oh,
and I just last night ran into Alex Call and heard him perform at the O'Hanlon Center. And Henry and Gloria Wax's daughter, Deborah, was at that same event last night. You know, she grew up in Mill Valley. And just, it's like, it's wonderful to be in your hometown and to be 73 years old and to be still meeting people who are so closely connected to your parents. You know, that weren't even perhaps my friends. I didn't even know them. Maybe my brother Richie knew Chip Collins. They were almost in the same class. And Chip Collins was the best friend of Alan Eshelman, who lived right here in the neighborhood. But, you know, to see these people years later and to feel that connection, which is deeper than any other root, you know, is just like a miracle. And happiness kind of reminds me of when I first came back to Mill Valley. I remember seeing George Cagwin somewhere, and George was an old friend, and seeing Carol Foss, my friend from across the street, or, you know, a few other people I knew, and feeling that I was truly walking in a state of grace to be back here.